Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Giustino. With us this week, John Caney. He's been on the program before. He's the executive director and co-founder of Reinvent Albany, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, tax-exempt charitable organization that promotes open, accountable New York State government with an interest in government transparency and public participation. In other words, John has his work cut out for him. Welcome back to the Capital Connection, John Caney.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with what's been happening in the news in Texas with redistricting and seemingly New York Governor Kathy Hochul leading the charge against redistricting, which involves, well, doing redistricting off calendar in New York. For someone who follows this at Reinvent Albany, this can't be good.
No, it's not good. And I think the governor's logic here, as well as the other state Democratic leaders, is not very coherent. I mean, they're arguing that that essentially the United States is in a state of civil war, and that anything goes in war, and that includes rights and rule of law and respect for basic principles of democratic governance. And we think that New York will not save America's democracy by depriving large numbers of our own voters of a voice through extreme gerrymandering and drawing legislative districts, especially congressional districts, in a way so that minority party, in this case, Republican voters, will not have nearly as much weight to their votes as Democratic voters in other districts. So being like Texas is, in our view, not something that New York should aspire to do. And we think there are better paths for saving democracy than wrecking democracy.
Well, and the redistricting process itself, as it's practiced, is one of the most undemocratic processes around, and that's beyond many average Americans' understanding. And the idea that it's now going to become redistricting 2.0, where we're going to not follow the rules and try to gerrymander, the correct name, gerrymander the districts for our party, to me, just simply is the wrong tact, that Americans are already dissatisfied with a lot of the corruption they perceive in politicians, Washington, New York, or otherwise. And this is just going to further cement that.
We'd certainly agree with you on that, as would many of the other groups that promote voting and democratic rights in New York and you know, fight against the abuse of power by government. To us, the Democrats in New York would be making a big, big mistake by trying to raise Texas to the bottom and engage in what's called extreme gerrymandering, which is having your legislature draw the district lines of legislative districts in a way that yields the maximum possible number of seats for the majority party. In this case, it would be Republicans in Texas and Democrats in New York, because for Democrats, it really blurs the difference between the parties. Now Democrats could say, rightly, hey, we're the party of voting rights. You know, we're the party of rule of law, of trying to fulfill the both the spirit and the letter of the U.S. Constitution and our own state's constitution in empowering the citizen to have the greatest voice they can and have a true representative democracy. And those are high-minded concepts, but really that's what the United States is based on, and the Constitution of New York is based on. So if you're racing Texas to the bottom, you're really putting forth the question, what's the difference between Democrats and Republicans if they're both completely cynical and seeking to deprive their own people of a voice in selecting their leaders, then, you know, to the hell with everybody. And that's unfortunately where things are headed. So we believe in terms of a political narrative really just doing the right thing, that Democrats in New York would be just making a huge mistake, both intrinsically because they would be seeking to deprive, again, large numbers of New Yorkers of a fair voice in how their legislature is composed, and also because they're blurring the lines between the good guys and the bad guys in a way that makes no sense. And one of the dumber things about this whole discussion is the idea that, hey, we're going to show Texas, you know, we can be as bad as they are. But it's a cut off your nose to spite your face type thing, because depriving New Yorkers of a fair voice in their government doesn't do anything to Texas. I mean, it's an absurd proposition. Plus, this is such a long drawn out process in New York that this would not affect any political races until 2028 if New York was to move forward with attempt to change the state constitution. And lastly, I would note something that people have not been talking about, which is I think it's completely questionable as to whether New Yorkers would vote to support a change in the constitution of the kind proposed in what would be 2027. And I would point out that there would be an unlimited amount of political spending for and against such an amendment allowed, and that groups like ours and the editorial boards would be strongly opposing what the governor and legislative leaders here, Democrats, have been talking about doing. And I don't think it's a sure thing that New Yorkers, which, by the way, are increasingly not affiliated with either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. We're looking at numbers now that show big declines in both parties' registrations, and the largest single party in New York is no party. And that's a phenomenon that's been accelerating. So why independent voters Republican voters and many Democrats would support something that would allow extreme gerrymandering by allowing the state legislature to draw district lines instead of the semi-independent redistricting process we have now, which admittedly is highly imperfect, but is still vastly better than a legislature that is by its own, you know, intent, hell-bent on being able to engage in extreme gerrymandering as part of a national strategy. Why would the public support that? I find that a very dubious proposition. So, and also would go so far as to wonder why people in Democrats in California think it's a sure thing that Californians would support, you know, a public referendum that would allow extreme gerrymandering there.
We're speaking with John Caney, executive director and co-founder of Reinvent. I'm David Gustina. You're listening to the Capital Connection. But of course, you hinted that even with an independent redistricting commission or committee, it's a little complicated. Who appoints the people on the commission? How many appointees do they get? Then there's the idea of judge shopping when, for example, the Republicans sue or the Democrats sue, and then they try to put it in a venue where they get a judge with a favorable ear. So all these amount to the complexity of the political system when it comes to redistricting.
Yeah, look, there's a way forward, and it's been pointed to, which is to have a independent process that results in an independent redistricting commission. And importantly, and much to her credit, you know, Governor Hochul has tried to do this with the State Ethics Commission, and the results have been, you know, much better than anyone expected in the independent process, which just survived a big constitutional court challenge by Andrew Cuomo, who doesn't want to pay $5 million back for his COVID book. But that's another tale to tell. But so there are processes that allow legislative leaders, the governor, both in the majority and the minority, and even the comptroller and the state attorney general could certainly have appointees that would produce an independent redistricting commission that would seek to have the fairest possible districts. And that's something that in this age is very, very doable because computers are so, so good at drawing district lines now, both for good and bad. So it's a doable thing, and it could happen here, but not in the direction we're going at the moment.
Now let's turn to something I think is also a bit political, like redistricting and what Governor Hochul and the legislature aren't doing, which is haven't yet met in a special session. We have all these cuts from Washington. We're seeing these congressional town halls and people so angry at what's happening. And in New York, it seems like they're taking a wait and see. They're going to let the cuts happen and then blast the Republicans and blame them for the cuts, as opposed to meeting and trying to mitigate them now.
Yes, all true. I think you nailed it there. The New York, more than any other state in the United States, is going to be heavily negatively affected by the Trump administration's radical restructuring of Medicaid and a huge reduction in federal, in particular Medicaid aid, but also other kinds of federal aid. And New York's economy, more than any other in the United States, is centered around Medicaid that it, goes to a very, very expansive entitlement program for New Yorkers. And that's been a strategy of New York's for some decades, which is actually a pretty smart strategy, which is to use Medicaid as a, not just for direct medical care, but also as a form of transfer payments, welfare payments to help lift up the poorest and most vulnerable New Yorkers. And in some ways, as a jobs program. And the in New York, federal government matches a dollar, dollar for dollar every dollar the state spends. And so New York had the smart idea, in our view, some decades ago of, hey, you know, we put a dollar in, we get a dollar back of federal money. That's a way of getting some of our federal tax dollars back, because more than any other state over the last decades, New York has been a donor state to Washington. That is, other than during COVID, New York State and New Yorkers paid more in federal taxes than New York got back in federal aid. So Medicaid has been a central part of the, you could call it the political economy of New York State, the economic model. And that's why these radical changes in how Medicaid eligibility works is going to be huge, huge hit, direct hit on New York. And, you know, it's dire, but as your remarks suggest, what's happening here is that Democrats want to make sure that the public understands that it's the Trump administration that has the blame for what are going to be big, big cuts to the Medicaid program here and reductions in who can receive Medicaid and for what. And they want to make sure, especially since next year is a gubernatorial election year, that there's no confusion, that it is the Trump administration and the Republicans who are inflicting this pain on vulnerable New Yorkers and not the Democrats. So that, in this case, politics is getting in the way of what would be good planning and a more transparent and grown-up way of saying, hey, you know, this big storm is coming. How do we all get together here and prepare for this? And instead, what we have is a kind of elaborate theater in which the governor and the legislature are pretending, we're pretending through the budget process that basically Trump was not the president and that everything was the same as it normally is, which of course it's not.
John Caney, I want to turn to a different subject entirely, and it came out of me reading your blog. You have a blog, the title, Five Ways That Corporate and Economic Development Subsidies Fuel Racial Inequality. That caught my eye. Can you tell our listeners more about that?
Sure. We have a weekly bulletin called Subsidy Sheet that highlights aspects of the $11 billion a year that New York State and local governments spend on corporate subsidies through tax abatements and tax credits and various ways in which the taxpayer underwrites businesses, big businesses here. And we reprinted in part a essay by a national leader in combating corporate subsidies, Greg LeRoy, in which he identified how pernicious these subsidies are in actually encouraging racial inequality. And he gave a whole bunch of examples, but I can give you a whole bunch of examples right off the bat. And I'll start with one of New York's favorite projects, which is Micron. And note that Micron, which
John, this is computer chips, right? In central New York, Syracuse?
That's right. That's right. And you called it Syracuse, but in newspaper accounts, it's called Clay. And for those who haven't been to Syracuse, Clay is on the north border of Syracuse, and it's a very, very small suburb. But when you look, and I'm not pointing out that Micron's any worse than many other projects. It's not. It's just in the headlines, so we'll use it there. The Micron is not in the city limits of Syracuse. And that's an interesting thing because there's plenty of room inside Syracuse where there's old industrial sites called brownfields and places that you can stick giant computer chip fabs. But likewise, I should say that when you go to Albany and you look at the Albany area where the state's invested tens of billions in computer chip manufacturing, Global Foundries, for instance, those are not in the city limits of Albany.
Nope.
Now, Syracuse and Albany and Rochester and Buffalo are all among America's poorest small cities. And it's notable that the state's putting tens of billions into these computer chip fabs, basically to try to create good jobs. And yet, none of them are actually within the city limits of the cities that are struggling the most.
So why, John? Why do they do that?
What they're doing is trying to avoid the politics and taxes of the inner cities. And the places in New York where you have the most non-white residents are those poor cities within those city limits. And so by moving all of this enormous economic development subsidy into projects that are in the suburbs, you are automatically making it more difficult for the residents of those inner cities to be able to access those jobs. Now, I don't think that that's the intent and that there's, you know, that there's some evil back room where, you know, New York State's leaders are trying to do that at all. But that's what has happened. And what that essay that we put out showed is that that happens again and again and again. And that when you analyze where corporate subsidies go, they're not going to the places that have the highest unemployment and highest poverty and most need the good jobs. So by taking that public investment and putting it into suburban areas that are not the most economically distressed, you're making a decision about how you're using, you know, those tax dollars and how you're defining economic development. And you're kind of disconnecting it from inner city poverty and the need for investment there, which is a bit odd, given that New York Democrats spend a lot of time gnashing their teeth about what to do with these, you know, post-industrial cities that are mired in all kinds of problems having to do with population loss and, you know, reduced tax base, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what that essay is pointing to. It's saying that let's look at where the numbers, let's look at where the investment goes. And indeed, when you apply that, which is a national analytic framework to New York, you see that it applies here too. And that money does not, economic development money does not go in the, you know, in huge amounts into inner cities, but instead goes to suburbs and exurban areas, including places that are hundreds of miles from population centers that are kind of weird, like the stamp plant that's about 70 miles east of Buffalo in a very rural part of upstate New York that has incredibly few people, but is a place where New York has spent hundreds of millions of dollars developing a technology center on tax-free land. And you wonder why. So that's why we thought it was worse, but that's why we highlighted that.
Yeah, you know, one of the other things that is impacting all of us, not just in New York, is climate change. And New York has a number of initiatives for environmental regulation and climate change mitigation, but many have not made it through. And when it comes to Hochul's energy plan, you also have something on the Subsidy Sheet blog about that. Explain.
Yeah, that's right. There's another disconnect between the state to public investment and the climate goals here. And a key one of those is that the state is subsidizing big energy consumers like data centers in particular with very low cost hydropower from Niagara Falls in particular through a program called Recharge New York. And basically the state is giving low, low, low cost power to places that use lots and lots of power. And to just put it in perspective, the average household in New York pays about three times the amount for electricity as what these big data centers are getting. So that doesn't make a lot of sense to us because it's a perverse incentive for those big electricity consumers to not save electricity. When you lower the price of something, you means people are going to consume more of it. And this leads to a big, big issue here, which is who's going to pay for the governor's 1 gigawatt nuclear plant? And is it going to be big energy users in industry, or is it going to be the average household?
Also, John, I believe I heard just this week that the head of NYSERDA, the energy authority, said we're not going to make many of these climate goals.
That's right. New York is not going to hit most of the sustainable power, solar, wind goals, which are very, very ambitious, but also have been seen in a separate, you know, they use the word silo or space from economic development instead of being in the central space. So the state's doing some very paradoxical things, contradictory things in providing super cheap power to data centers, which, by the way, employ very, very few people because they're mainly just racks and racks of computers that are sitting there using electricity and water. At the same time, it's trying to reduce carbon emissions and build more sustainable power. So it just, it doesn't make sense, and it's illogical. And you know, that's, I guess, the nature of things, but it is the kind of thing that makes you wonder, okay. And by the way, I would point out that Micron is a humongous energy consumer. You know, shouldn't Micron be paying the same price as, you know, a working class family for electricity rather than much, much cheaper than that working class family? So there's all kinds of issues with the sustainable power, with this nuke plant, with economic development strategy that that don't make sense and are economically irrational, but also, you know, socially regressive, because your power bill, which is, by way, as everyone knows, is skyrocketing for everyone. Your power bill is not adjusted for your income. It's a very regressive form of collecting money, because poor people and wealthy people pay the same amount for their electricity. That money that's collected for your power bill, in part, is being used to subsidize data centers and places like the big Micron plant. So all of these things don't add up, and that's a problem.
Yeah, and we don't even have time to bring in the fact that Lee Zeldin, the New Yorker who's now running the EPA, is systematically dismantling regulations to help the environment. But we'll have to leave that for another program. Our guest has been John Caney, Executive Director, co-founder of Reinvent Albany. To find out more, head to reinventalbany.org. John, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us on the Capital Connection.
Thank you for having me. Enjoyed it.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.